Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. I'll just adjust the microphone briefly. Senator Conroy makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here quite a few times before, and he's always welcome, and it's great to have him back. A very busy minister in the cabinet, and it's great that he's spending time with us tonight. I'll introduce him very briefly. Educated in economics at the Australian National University. He's been in the Senate for Victoria since 1996, held a number of senior roles in opposition, but of course since the election of the Rudd Labor government, Senator Conroy has been the Minister for Broadband Communications and the Digital Economy, and of course Deputy Leader of the Government in the Senate. And tonight Senator Conroy is going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the broad topic of reform unleashes transformation. Senator Conroy, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back again. In the lead-up to tonight's address, I cast my eye over the speech I gave the last time that I was here. And that was in May 2008. And the level of change that has occurred in that relatively short period is extraordinary. My speech then outlined the government's plans for the media and telecommunications sector into the future. In my view, no other sector is changing as quickly or as significantly as this one. We live in a time when new technologies are transforming our daily lives and breaking down old barriers. I wonder how many people in this room can't live without their iPhone or BlackBerry. I have to admit, I've got both. We live in a time when threshold policy decisions made today will have far-reaching and transformative implications for the future. As we move into the digital age, governments have a responsibility to drive and shape this transformation of the economy and society. The Rudd government has been bold in pushing ahead with necessary reforms and policies to put Australia at the forefront of the communications revolution. There is no doubt that some of these reforms are difficult and some of these challenge special interests. All of them will strengthen our economy and improve the quality of life for all Australians. Not so long ago, fast broadband was seen as a luxury item. In the 21st century, it has become an essential item, an essential utility, like water and gas and electricity. It has the potential to end the tyranny of distance once and for all, but only if everyone has access to it. The Rudd government has made investments in high-speed broadband infrastructure a top priority. Just last week, I marked 1 year since the Rudd government's historic announcement that it would establish a new company, NBN Co, to build and operate a new wholesale-only superfast broadband network. The National Broadband Network, or NBN as we like to call it, is the largest nation-building project in our history. It will transform our economy, drive future growth, drive future productivity, lead to new innovative health services, and help our children get the best education in the world. Under our NBN policy, every home, every business, every school, and every hospital will receive high-speed broadband. no one will be left behind. The NBN will connect 90% of premises with fibre to the home technology, providing speeds of 100 meg, and remaining premises with next generation wireless and satellite services that will deliver our election commitment of 12 meg or more. It will support 25,000 jobs every year on average over the life of the 8-year project. The NBN will lift Australia to the top of world rankings in broadband access. We will join leading countries in our own region, such as Korea, Japan, and Singapore, that have prioritised investment in ubiquitous high-speed fibre broadband networks. What we are doing here in Australia is being watched closely by other Western economies. This includes the US and the UK, which have both, since our announcement last April, developed policies aimed to put them on the path towards delivering high-speed broadband of 100 meg to their citizens. 1 year on from our announcement, we have made significant progress on this historic project. The physical rollout in Tasmania commenced late last year, and the first superfast broadband services are due to begin in Tasmania from July this year. On the mainland, the first building blocks of the NBN are already being put in place, with 6,000 kilometres of optical fibre backbone being laid to 100 different locations in regional Australia. Since the rollout began in Mount Isa in February, over 400 kilometres have been laid, and these investments are expected to directly benefit around 395,000 regional and rural Australians. NBNCo has also announced the first 5 release sites where fibre to the premise technology will be deployed on the mainland. These sites will be used to test network design and construction methods and will provide crucial information to assist in the rollout of the NBN. Work is due to begin on these sites in the second half of the year, with services available from early next year. And while the Rudd government is getting on with transforming broadband services for all Australians, we're also getting on with delivering important complementary reforms in the communications sector. As a wholesale-only network, the NBN will fundamentally transform competition and consumer choice in the communications sector. We are committed to putting in place the necessary protections in legislation, including a wholesale-only network to enshrine these principles. Getting the structure of the communications sector right for the long term is a critical step towards unleashing the sort of competition that will benefit Australian consumers and Australian businesses. It is a reform that is long overdue. It is a reform the previous Labor government failed to achieve. It is a reform that the previous coalition government ignored and exacerbated by privatising a vertically integrated Telstra. It ignored all the advice. It didn't conduct a study into the long-term effects on competition, despite repeated urgings from the National Competition Council. The cost of these policy failures, spanning both the governments, as I said, has been compounded in an age when telecommunications networks are much more than just about providing voice calls. The NBN gets the market structure right for the long term. But we cannot wait for the progressive 8-year rollout to reform the communications sector. That is why we introduced and currently have before the Senate reforms to improve the structure and competition safeguards in the communications sector today. This bill has been widely misunderstood. It's often described simply as a bill about Telstra. And while there are measures in this bill to address the unprecedented level of vertical and horizontal integration we have in the Australian telco sector, this bill has a much broader focus and includes measures to improve other competition and consumer safeguards. These reforms are essential in the long-term national interest. They will ensure that we have a competitive communications sector that delivers for consumers and business. Building a national broadband network for all Australians and designing appropriate regulations around the new and existing networks is only part of the story of the Rudd government's reform agenda. What we do with it and how we use it to enhance our everyday lives will be far more important. Some critics continue to question whether the government should invest in high-speed broadband networks. Others question whether we will in fact ever need broadband that delivers 100 megs per second. Critics argue that the delivery of high-speed broadband can and should be left to the private market to sort out. I'm often faced with the question, I can't imagine what I would do with 100 megs. And I borrow from my friend Larry Smar in the US, where he says, well, that's a failure of your imagination, not 100 megs. A useful analogy to consider is, what if the same argument had prevailed in relation to investments in electricity networks in the 19th century? Looking back, we now know that wide-scale, government-led investment in ubiquitous electricity distribution networks created the platform that transformed economies and societies. These investments generated benefits not only for the immediate impacts they had, but also on the transformation they helped create. Last year, Glenn Fleischman's article, The Killer App of 1900, compared broadband in 2010 to electricity in 1900. And he said, 100 years ago, lighting was the killer app for electricity, the thing that made it worthwhile to have installed. No one particularly understood what else electricity might bring to the mass market. Compressors to allow refrigeration and freezing, electric heat and other innovations came later to homes. He went on to say, we may think we know all the means to which high-speed internet access may be put, but we clearly do not. YouTube and Twitter prove that new things are constantly on the way and will emerge as bandwidth and access continues to increase. I mean, 2 years ago, or when I last spoke to you, I think in May 2008, had the iPhone even been launched? I'm just trying to remember when it was launched. Maybe not. David shaking his head. In that just over two-year period, 150,000 apps have been invented and put onto iPhone. Sure, some of them are frivolous, some of them are silly, but a lot of them are actually really, really useful. But who could have, if someone had said to you, Steve, tell me what this bloody iPhone is going to be used for, you'd have gone, oh, God, I don't know, you know. But you knew it was going to make a difference. 150,000 apps and God knows how many more to come. So fast broadband will deliver more than just high-speed telecommunications. It is about better access to health services for Australian families, better education opportunities for Australian kids, creating new business opportunities and stimulating Australia's economy. And it is about creating and keeping jobs here in Australia. Rural and regional Australia will have access to opportunities that until now have been inconceivable. The Chief Executive of the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association, Chris Oldfield, has said, and I quote, for farming, it will be revolutionary. It will change forever what we do and the way we do it. Mr. Oldfield said the practical farming applications of the NBN include instant access to market and weather information, the ability to operate irrigators remotely, or 24/7 tracking of livestock through electronic tagging. The task ahead in the new digital age is to adapt to the changes and take advantage of the opportunities that it offers. The internet is the greatest transformation tool we have ever seen, and the Rudd government is ensuring that Australia takes advantage of every opportunity it presents through the NBN. But while the internet is poised to become even more central to our lives and much more accessible, can it, as many currently argue, remain completely unregulated. With great opportunity comes great responsibility. And having sensible, appropriate protections in place is the role of government. There are some who want to argue that on the internet, people should be able to publish anything they like, regardless of whether it contravenes laws in the offline world. The internet is an incredible piece of technology in our lifetime, and it's unlikely we'll see anything like it again. But for all its technical brilliance, the internet is a distribution and communications platform. Having no regulation to combat illegal activity actually weakens all that is good about the internet. The government has always maintained there is no silver bullet when it comes to cyber safety, and we have never said that ISP-level filtering alone would help fight child pornography or keep children safe online. The government's $125.8 million cyber safety policy incorporates a range of measures, including law enforcement, research, education, and awareness. The Rudd government does not support refused classification content being available on the internet. This content includes child sexual abuse imagery, bestiality, sexual violence, detailed instruction in crime, violence or drug use, and or material that advocates the doing of a terrorist act. It is a very narrow, very defined set of criteria. Not that you would necessarily know that if you'd listened to all of the debate. But under Australia's existing classification regulations, this material, just so you're absolutely clear, this material is not available in news agencies. It's not on your library shelves. You cannot watch it on a DVD or at the cinema, and it's certainly not shown on television. Refused classification material is not available today on Australian-hosted websites. It's already been blocked. And the government's proposal will bring the treatment of overseas-hosted content into line by requiring ISPs to block overseas content that has been identified as refused classification. This is a modest measure which reflects long-held community standards about the type of content that is accepted in a civilised society. Those who claim that the government's approach is akin to the sort of political censorship practiced by authoritarian regimes are simply misleading the Australian public. And the good news is the Australian public aren't buying it. For all the claims you've heard in the last 12 months, this is the great firewall of China, the Australian public do not regard blocking the content I have described as the equivalent of political censorship. Australians have long listened to this debate, and no one has yet convinced them that this sort of material equates to censorship. No matter how many times the critics of mine in the last 12 months or so have tried to make the claim. The transformation in the communications sector is much broader than investment in high-speed broadband and the challenge of designing appropriate regulations around it. We're in the early phase of a transformation of the entire media broadcasting landscape. New waves of technology are driving convergence in the ability of networks to provide a broader array of services and for market structures to change. One core part of this transformation is the switchover that is currently underway from analog to digital TV. The switch to digital television will free up scarce spectrum, which can be used for new communication services such as high-speed wireless broadband. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for Australia to take advantage of this important economic infrastructure. This spectrum is often referred to as the digital dividend, and realisation of the digital dividend is a key element of the government's broader communications policy. In January, I released the Digital Dividend Green Paper, which set out the government's objective to reclaim 126 megahertz currently used for analog television broadcasts. Submissions on the Green Paper closed last month. Importantly, the submissions showed that there is widespread support across the broadcasting sector and communications sector for achieving the government's target dividend. In order to achieve this dividend, we need to switch from analogue to digital television. When I was last here, I signalled the government's intention to switch to digital television to be completed by the end of 2013. I'm pleased to report there has been much progress. We are just 79 days away from the first region in Australia, Mildura Sunraysia, switching to digital-only television. The Digital Switchover Task Force has been working effectively and cooperatively with broadcasters to undertake the planning needed to switch off analogue TV. There is a great deal of technical and legislative work going on behind the scenes to get ready for the switch to digital. But for the viewer, the most obvious change is the arrival of new television channels. Since the government announced the end date for analogue TV, Australia's free-to-air commercial broadcasters have embraced the opportunity to provide new services to their audiences. All have launched digital-only multi-channels over the last 18 months. It is fair to say that the subscription television industry has been moving at a much faster pace. As all of you who've got subscription television services would know, the full switch to digital was completed quite some time ago. More channels, more services, more content. In a country as vast and as sparsely populated as Australia, the provision of communication services in rural and remote areas has always been a particular challenge. Most people who live in Sydney or Melbourne do not realise that many, many hundreds of thousands of Australians do not actually get three commercial television stations in their hometowns. Most of us just blithely go through our entire lives in Sydney, Melbourne, thinking, everyone gets this, don't they? Well, the truth is they don't. And this is actually a very, very exciting development for them. So, in January, the government announced that as part of the switch to digital television, we will be funding a new satellite service. This service will finally bring to viewers across the country the television services long enjoyed by urban Australians. Legislation introduced into Parliament last month will underpin the new satellite service. The new service will provide viewers with access to their local news. For some, this will be the first time, something that existing analogue satellite services just didn't do. Now, supporting industry to enable creativity and responsiveness, sustaining Australian content and prioritising the needs of the audience is at the centre of the government's approach to media policy. It is why we strongly backed Australia's national broadcasters, the ABC and SBS. A healthy and diverse media needs both commercial and national broadcasters to play strong roles, engaging in creative pursuits and fostering competitive tension. Last year, in the middle of the most significant global economic downturn in 75 years, the government was able to give the ABC its biggest funding boost since it was incorporated in 1983 and to find new funding for SBS to produce more local content. This funding increase has already seen the arrival of the long-awaited ABC Children's Channel, and is being leveraged throughout regional Australia to produce user-generated content and provide online media education to regional communities through the ABC Open project, as it's known. And later this year, the ABC has also announced a new 24-hour news channel will be launched. Across the broadcasting and media sectors, we are seeing significant transformation. And once again, reform is needed to keep up with these changes. In our discussion paper on telecommunications reform for the 21st century, the government flagged its intention to consider the overall regulatory framework for communications services in a converged environment. As I said previously, regulatory issues such as media diversity, ownership controls, audience reach rules, and local content obligations will all need to be revisited. The government's policies, particularly in creating NBN and pursuing the switch to digital-only television, have rapidly accelerated the arrival of the convergent media age in Australia after years of delay. It is crucial that the appropriate regulatory settings are in place to foster competition, encourage diversity, inspire creativity, and protect Australian voices. I believe that when history is written on the significance of the changes underway in the communications sector, it will be compared with the Industrial Revolution in its transformative impact on society. I agree with the proposition that it's difficult to appreciate rapid progress when you're in the middle of it, but looking back highlights just how dramatic the changes have been. Only 10 short years ago, just over 1 in 2 people had a mobile phone, mainly for calls, and texting was considered to be cutting edge. Mass market broadband services were in their infancy, and few people even knew what it was. There was, as we said, no iPhone, let alone the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of applications that have come from it. There was no iPad. There was no digital TV multi-channels, and the idea of watching TV on demand was something we'd heard about overseas. And of course, the pioneers of YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook were still penniless nerds yet to make their mark. I'll be one of the first in line for the new iPad when it arrives in Australia later this month. But I've got no doubt that in another 10 years, someone else will be standing here using it to highlight how times have changed. The transformation currently underway in the media and communication sector is unprecedented in this country. Never before in the modern era have we experienced such sweeping changes in one sector. The opportunities presented by this transformation will be spectacular, and we need to make sure Australia can take advantage of them. Moore's Law is still going to be kicking around, I reckon, for another 30 to 40 years. So it's just going to get smaller and faster, which will just continue the transformation. It's why the Rudd government is investing in the foundations for this transformation in the digital economy in the future. It's why reforming communications to drive and shape this transformation are so important. And could I thank Jared and the Institute again for the invitation? It's always a pleasure to be here. And am I taking questions as usual?
Yeah.
Thanks, many thanks to the Minister. Thanks also to Clayton Utz for the use of this great facility this evening. So we come to questions, discussion, and finish no later than 7 o'clock. So, can I start off? I think when you were last here, and thanks for coming back, you spoke then about broadband before the proposed broadband network. And I think you said that the expenditure the government had in mind was something close to $5 billion, and this would be equivalent to the Snowy Mountains development under the Chifley government. Now it's the possibility is, what, $45 billion tops? $43 billion tops. And the countries you've spoken about tonight, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, as you know, are physically small countries. I mean, is this? You still think this is economically manageable? It's a real challenge, but you're confident it can be done?
Look, we're very confident. As you'd all know, we've had McKinsey's and KPMG doing what we call the Lead Advisors study, which we've had for about a month now, and we're going to be releasing in the next couple of weeks. There isn't a set date yet, so don't have the journos jump up now and go, which day? But it will be released before the budget, as we said. So the budget is only 4 weeks away, so that's your outer envelope. And the Lead Advisors report will be really interesting reading. I think it'll surprise a lot of people. It contains a lot of really useful information. But I think what all Australians have been crying out for, if you travel around Australia, and particularly into regional rural Australia, but I'd love to tell you it's just regional rural Australia, you can travel right throughout Perth, you can travel right throughout Tasmania, right throughout Adelaide, right throughout the growing edges of Melbourne and Sydney, and find people who are basically crying out because they're still on dial-up. People have moved to the outer fringes, and they've moved from ADSL back to dial-up. And that's like moving into a house with no washing machine or electricity, because people are just desperate for this transformation to take place. So we believe, we've always believed that when we set out on this project that it was viable. We've always believed it was able to be achieved, irrespective of other interests from other players in the market. And I would say this, whether Catherine was in the room or not, but we're lucky enough to have Catherine, the chair of Telstra, here tonight. And it is a project that can always be built faster and cheaper if a negotiated settlement can be reached with Telstra. And to save on some of the inevitable questions, we are obviously been talking for a few months now, and we are in a position where there will ultimately be an outcome one way or the other. I'm not predicting an outcome. But for those who are interested Telstra shareholders here tonight, I can assure you, Catherine and David have been representing your interests famously. You have nothing to fear. I have the scars to prove it. And I would say that whether Catherine was here or not. But yeah, we've always believed it was viable. We've always believed it can deliver on the project as a whole.
There's a question here, and Rafi, and then we go down there. Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Minister. You spoke tonight about the very real benefits of a high-speed broadband network, yet at the same time you're planning to introduce a filter that critics have claimed can censor some websites, can slow some websites by up to 80%. How do you plan to implement a filter without at the same time slowing some websites?
Yeah, I'm always amazed by the capacity for the sector to take a modest issue and actually make it bigger than the actual network. That is a total fabrication. Those who've advanced that argument know it's a fabrication. It's always been a fabrication. BT have been running a clean feed for years without destroying... The internet works in the UK. This has been a complete fabrication. We've gone through a year-long trial process to prove it was a fabrication. And Telstra did their own separate non-government, not paid for by us, they did their own study. They came back and they said 1/70th of the blink of an eye is the impact for an end user. It's always been the case. It's been the case overseas. It's been the case here. But we said we'd be evidence-based in our project, and we have got the evidence it's in. Now the so-called experts are trying to pretend, oh, it wasn't tested on the national broadband network. Well, there isn't a national broadband network yet, but it is scalable. It is simply scalable. And the people who are trying to make that argument know that as well. But they were happy to perpetrate the 87% myth. They're happy to try and tell you now that it's scalable. But it is frustrating that, as I said, we've got this small issue. It's a modest initiative. It's overshadowing the entire debate around what is truly going to be the most transformative change in Australia in 50, 60, 70 years. And I'm happy to debate it. I got the first half hour Q&A all to myself. I did Dateline on SBS all to myself. And I've done the 7:30 report. I'm happy to keep discussing it just to try and nail some of these myths, because they are largely myths designed to mislead people about what's happening.
There's a question here.
My name's Wayne Hawkins. It's great to hear you, Senator Conroy, and I share a lot of your enthusiasm for this transformation. I think it's really fantastic. But as somebody who's in the last few years gone blind, I feel fearful that the more things advance, the more I'm going to be disenfranchised, the more I'm going to be left behind as a blind person. And there's no audio description in cinema in Australia. There's no audio description on television. There's this plethora of new station channels that are going to be available. I'm not going to be able to have access to them because I won't be able to operate a set-top box or a digital television because they don't have audio menus. And as exciting as that all of this stuff is, I'm literally going to be left in the dark.
Now, look, that's a
question, please.
Oh, look, that's a. I'll take that as a question. We are currently working. Sure.
Well, we've got the question. That's fine. We understand the question.
No, I've been working very closely with Bill Shorten, our Parliamentary Secretary on Disabilities. We've got a couple of reviews that are very close to being completed about how we can use the new technologies in the UK. Sky have downloaded some fantastic applications onto their set-top box that make it very, very usable for people with disabilities. There is a lot of very exciting new technology that we need to harness as we go into this transformation, try and put it on the ground floor so we don't try to need to bolt it on later, to actually get it into the thinking of people who are designing these things right now. And we are close to announcing a couple of important initiatives with Bill Shorten, working with the disability community. And in terms of cinemas and those sorts of things, the TV stations, we're in dialogue with them about wanting to increase the captioning requirements and what other things we can do to address the legitimate concerns. I mean, this is a technology that if you talk to the disability groups in the UK, that change that Sky put into their boxes, they just cannot sing the praises of it fast enough. So we're in a situation where the technology is available, and there is even newer technology coming along that is making these issues even simpler to deal with. It requires focus, it requires dedication, it requires a little bit of commitment from the sector. Sometimes they're not always great at taking the first step forward, but we're in the process of nudging them to take those steps forward. So you've raised a very legitimate issue, and we are not going to leave Australians with a disability of any sort behind, where there's an easy application to be included along the way.
Okay, there's a question there. Let me come here. Yeah, quick.
First, I've got two questions.
No, you got one. Okay.
He is brutal, isn't he?
Oh, very quick. Yeah. First one, I'm a shareholder of Telstra. There's 1.4 million of us. What are you doing? We were plundered by the coalition government. What are you doing to take our interests into account? Never mind about what Telstra's doing. That's the first question. Yeah. Second question is, what gives you confidence to think that public servants are going to cost-effectively roll out anything?
Well, The good news is there are no public servants involved in rolling out the NBN. Mike Quigley is recognised as one of the world's leading and foremost engineers when it comes to rolling out networks. He's actually done it in the US in his previous occupation. And the people he's surrounded himself with are, last time I checked, almost exclusively from the telco sector. I mean, obviously a finance person is from the finance sector, but in terms of the engineering group that he's got around him, he's got some absolute telco experts who are actually designing this and working on this. So I think they have employed one public servant, maybe two. One of them is the company secretary, so he's got the legal qualifications to be able to do the job. In terms of Telstra's position, we started this on the basis of we have to do what's best for the national interest. We accept there is a legitimate Telstra interest as well, but we're not going to be governing on behalf of one group. We've took a view that there needed to be change in the sector. To give you a very simple example, in the 10 years since the access regime was introduced by the ACCC, in all of the other sectors, gas, water, electricity, airports, there have been 4 access disputes. In all the other sectors who live under this regime, there have been over 150 in the telecommunications sector. It is clearly not working. And we believe it was not working because decisions by previous governments. I'm not being political when I say this. I'm being critical of previous Labor governments and a good and close friend of mine, Kim Beazley, when I say this. This is a decision that should have not happened back in 1990 and was made worse in 1996 onwards. So we believe we have to govern in the national interest. We believe we have engaged very vibrantly, as I said, with Catherine and the board, who are, as I did say, and I laugh when I say it because I said I do have the scar tissue from these discussions. And you can rest assured that the Telstra management and board are representing your interests, and they don't need much help from me, I can tell you.
Yes, Steve Burton. Senator, as you know, I'm a supporter of your initiatives on fibre to the premises and digital dividend, but my question involves what impact your view of the digital economy in Australia would have on our productivity, and in particular, two aspects. The first, all that the Common Market have just come up with their agenda for the digital economy, and they believe that 50% of their future productivity will come from the technology. And secondly, the Treasury at the moment have us at a comparative low 1.4% productivity in the future. And I wondered if you had any plans or visions that could improve that.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to comment on Treasury's view, Treasury. there'd be plenty who would argue that's on the low side. But I'm not going to get drawn into a debate around Treasury figures. I think if you look at worldwide experience, wherever true fast broadband has been introduced, there are significant productivity gains. Bill Gates said a few years ago that 80% of the R&D in a car is now the IT. When I was in Las Vegas earlier this year, the development of IT in motor vehicles, and I'm talking about internet-enabled applications within cars, are extraordinary. They're about making things safer. They're about making driver reaction time better, less accidents. There is a raft of productivity benefits to come from the health sector. I mean, the ISOF people appeared before the Senate committee, and they're a fabulous Australian company that have got worldwide contracts. And the ISOF people said, look, the NBN will pay for itself twice in the first 10 years on health alone. And if you look at what health applications, aged care applications are available now, if homes were only equipped to be able to use them, the productivity savings in health, aged care, education are extraordinary. So what we've got is we're on the cusp of a revolution. The digital economy is actually running all of our lives already. Most people don't realise it. Everything we do now is just about touches with productivity. Whether you're working in a factory, a car factory, or most of the other sort of factories, it's all been digitised. The manufacturing process has been digitised from end to end. It's already happening. It's already happened in our offices. The digital economy is almost taking over every part of our economy. So that productivity boost that we're going to get is why we're doing the microeconomic reform in Spectrum, why we're doing the microeconomic reform in the fibre to the premise, which includes business, homes, schools, hospitals. We're absolutely passionate believers that this productivity boost is going to come. And that's why we are so determined to make sure that we get the necessary legislation through Parliament, that we deliver on the national broadband network, while we've hired the best people possible to deliver on the NBN.
Okay, so there's a question there.
If our progress in digitisation is so fast and so vast, are there any countries, cultures or areas in the world that are left behind, and based on globalisation we're supposed to communicate with everybody, since they're left behind, we have difficulties communicating with them?
Look, probably the most interesting transformation in South Korea, which is the most connected country at the moment. It's got well down the path to fibre to the home. Hasn't come, as people say, because you get faster downloads of movies. I hope by the end of this, if you believe nothing else, you believe that the national broadband network is not about downloading faster movies or faster emails. What's made the huge cultural difference in South Korea is the upload speed, because everybody has gone online. Everyone is putting up their own pages, they're putting up their own content. The real transformation in South Korea has been actually once you've got the upload speeds. And it has spawned almost a subculture is the wrong way, because it's their own culture, but it has actually strengthened their own culture, because they can now communicate with each other in other than English. I was in Egypt in November, and the international corporate governance, net governance, it was a forum about the net, and they're releasing new web addresses in other languages now. So you will see an uptake in communication among their own countries first. And so this is going to bring more and more people online. More and more people are going to be empowered. But it's that upload that makes the difference in terms of their own cultures. We're used to it because it's in English. It doesn't sound that exciting. Oh, a faster upload. But in these countries, it's actually what's making the real difference. It's not the download speed. It's the upload, the capacity for them to become their own publishers, to tell their own stories, for them to... Like in Australia, you know, every conspiracy theory in the world. I mean, when I was in Korea about 12 months ago, 18 months ago, and it was just at a time when the government had announced, it was a new government, 3 months old, and they just announced they were going to allow the import of beef from America again into South Korea. And this had spawned an entire internet conspiracy online that we're letting mad cow loose in South Korea again. And they said you can, if you've got the satellites, you can look down And you can see the cows that are wandering around that are infected, running around their own feces in America. Genetically, South Koreans are more disposed to catch it. I mean, you can get every great conspiracy theory in the world running on the net. And we're suffering a few. I'm suffering a few in Australia at the moment. But it is a transformation in the way that people's cultures can become active online because of the upload speed rather than just pure, hey, it's downloading faster.
Okay, I don't call journos as a rule because I've got a lot of members here. There's a question here. Yeah, and there's one down there. Okay.
So thank you for your address. It was so, quite erudite. I only have one question because I also share your enthusiasm, and that is the cost angle of the user cost. Now, I understand in Korea there was a great lag in the uptake, is my understanding of it, because when people realised what the cost was going to be, they said, I don't need all that. Yeah. So I don't. Are we going to face that sort of difficulty through some period where there won't be a great uptake? Look, and therefore a great cost to the community until that's recognised?
Yeah, now look, the good news is the one of the key issues addressed in the lead advisory report goes to this. But just last week, Internode, which are one of the first three companies we've announced in Tasmania that will be delivering services to consumers, because we're a wholesale company, announced that they be... it wasn't quite a Tasmanian announcement because we haven't finalised the actual negotiation. They said, look, we expect that in Tasmania we'll be offering 25 meg for about $40 to $50. Now, that is a very, very competitive offering. If you look at... So these figures you've heard about, $200 a month. I mean, look, that's a conspiracy theory put about by some rival competitors. And I don't mean Catherine and Telstra. there are some other individuals who have been notably doing it. But the sort of prices that are being talked about by Internode and IINet, which are going on to be some of our first service deliveries, are very exciting and very innovative. And I think you can see some really exciting announcements about the sort of products that are available online. Just in this morning's paper, IINet announced that they signed up with Fetch TV, the first IPTV company. And they're offering... is going to be very competitively priced, around $25 to $30, I think. That's a month on top of your actual internet connection for a whole range of services. So I think you're going to see real enthusiasm start to build and real price competitiveness start to come, because we're going to have basic wholesale price levels at very competitive prices.
There's a question down there, then we come up here. Oh, okay, there's one down the back.
Thank you, Minister. I think it's fantastic what the government's doing from a broadband perspective. And I know it's enabled our company, the company I run, to collaborate around the world, something we wouldn't afford to be able to do. But everything you're talking about seems very much about purchasing and those consumers needing to have more access to consumer items. What's the government going to do to enable business locally to transact with something from your...
Yeah, now look, I mean, because we're trying to describe to the majority of Australians the sort of benefits they'll get individually, we don't often talk, or I sometimes fail perhaps to communicate the small business story. Look, the cloud is going to be incredible. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. We are planning on having a roadshow go around to meet with all of the local councils and area, I think we call them regional development authorities now, to work with all the local councils to run little road shows in all the small country towns around the suburbs of Australia, with a show that will take them through the health benefits, the education benefits, the small business benefits. I mentioned the cloud before. The cloud is already active in some countries. I was in Singapore a while ago, and Singapore have already got these applications for small business. So instead of having to buy Myob, the whole of it, and then each year you get your download, you can just rent it for a couple of hours that you need it. So you put all the information up into the cloud and the answer comes down. You don't need to buy the whole thing. Now, this does have some tax implications for those who are interested in this, because if they're all overseas services and Australian companies aren't, like Myob, aren't suddenly being used because it's all in the cloud, there are some tax implications there which are going to be a real challenge for us. So Australian services need to be getting up into those clouds, so to speak. But there, I was in Adelaide a couple of weeks ago, and Playford, a council just on the inner fringe of their CBD, they already put some fibre into their small businesses. And to give you just a small example, there was a hairdressing company that say that they get now between 5 and 10 extra hairdressing appointments because they're now online per week. Because they've got their services advertised online, they can be easily found, easily accessed. There is a greengrocer in this same little strip that has his produce able to be, as soon as it's sold, it's logged, and it automatically sends off a request to their supplier for new boxes of apples or whatever it is. So the efficiencies that are being gained at small business level are dramatic as well. There are small vineyards, again, I travel around, so vineyards in South Australia, south of Adelaide, they are crying out for this. They want to put their produce online. They're actually on dial-up. You cannot run a business on dial-up. They are desperate to get access to real broadband to facilitate the sales of their wine on the international market. Farmers are desperate to be able to put their produce on. I met a farmer a couple of years ago. He's on satellite broadband, which is better than dial-up, just on a good day when it's not raining or cloudy. And he drives 35 minutes every night into, I think it was Bathurst, so that he can put his go to his visit his daughter's house, puts all his stuff up online, this is available now, and then drives home because he can't get access on his farm. So this is the sort of benefits to a whole raft of businesses that will be pretty quick once people understand the capacity. Yes, I still get, I think The Age went and door-knocked the strip shopping centre in Brunswick, and they went to a greengrocer who was in the strip shopping centre in Brunswick, which was one of the five first release sites. And they said, you know, fast broadband's coming. What do you think? He said, oh, as long as I've got electricity, I'm fine. I don't need anything else. So there is an education program. I'd love him to meet the greengrocer in Adelaide who has automated everything. And that's the sort of roadshows that we're going to be taking around Australia. They're not going to be run by my department. We're going to be seeking to have locals who understand that are part of the localised networks to encourage and tell these stories. But there are many, many stories like the three or four I've just described that will actually be of benefit to small businesses, and it's a very exciting story.
We've got the last two questions, one there and one here. Yeah.
If I was a farmer out of Bathurst, when could I expect to be able to get on?
Yeah, look, we're...
What's the timeline?
Yeah, look, the whole project will take 8 years. We've never tried to pretend for a moment this is not a massive nation-building project. So we hope to get to the 90% within 10 years. To put up a satellite, which is probably the most likely for the farmers who are a long way out, from the day you order a satellite, it's at least 3 years. So we've said if we can't get a decent deal with the existing satellite providers, we'll put two satellites up ourselves and do it ourselves. And the next generation of satellites are far superior to the existing generation of satellites. I've been when I was in Las Vegas, as I said, I went and tested some satellite broadband, and it's pretty cool. It's not fibre to the home. It's not going to give you 100 megs. The laws of physics, unfortunately, do apply still, despite the best story I could tell you. And it is a long way up to a satellite, and it's a long way down, and they have latency, and they have a whole variety of the laws of physics issues. But it is far superior to the satellites that are on the ground or in the air today. So from the day we sign a contract to deal with the satellite side of it, it takes 3 years. It's just a queue. It takes 3 years to work it up. So they've called for, NBNCo, we've called for expressions of interest about supplying satellites, and that process will just go on in the normal commercial ways. But from the day they sign the contract, it's 3 years after that.
You're very firm on the point that the ISP filtering system is not censorship. But Australians are, by the level of debate, you can tell, naturally
suspicious,
nervous about the possibility that websites will fall into the net. What kind of features of the actual system can Australians look to feel secure that that's not
true? Sure. Look, there's two things about the debate. One of them I think is accidental. Some of it I think is malicious, but one of the things is accidental. Everyone thinks we're going to filter the entire net and then decide through this filter what it is that you're going to see. It's not actually what's happening. This system works on a complaints-based mechanism. And what happens is we regularly receive updates from international policing agencies that particularly they focus on the child porn side of the debate. And so we regularly get supplied with, here's a list of addresses on the World Wide Web that have got child porn sites. So currently 355 of them that are there. They move, they rotate, they change, they're very smart, the the sort of organised rings that do this sort of stuff. So you've got to be constantly vigilant and updating and deleting. And that's why the famous story about the pool cleaner in Queensland and the dog groomer in Queensland. Their sites were hacked. Then after a while, they were added to the list, they took it down. As in, the person who owned those sites didn't even know it had happened, because it's not the main part of the site. It was a backslash, forward slash. So they didn't even know it had happened to. So this is a complaints-based mechanism. There's two ways to get on it. The first is international agencies will put the list to us that they're doing, and then there is a complaints-based mechanism for any Australian. You can say, hey, I think that's terrible, I think that falls within the refused classification, and then it's put forward. Now, the greatest fear that Australians have, and they should have, is about the secrecy of the list, because I get asked this all the time. Just publish the list. Publish the addresses. Unlike books and films and movies, when you publish a title, you're not publishing access to that material. If I publish the list of website specific page addresses, and it is specific pages within a website, I've actually provided access to this material. So I have struggled with this one. This is the hardest of the parts of the debate. So we put out a paper when we made our announcement in December that said we need a greater level of transparency and accountability. So we asked Australians, tell us what you think is a really good extra measure. At the moment, the census, the classification board are arm's length from government. And we want a process where it can be, the list can be independently vetted. So some of the ideas that have come forward are a retired judge should look at the list every 6 months to make sure Steve Conroy, Kevin Rudd haven't slipped any extra things onto this list that shouldn't be there. Others are a representative group from the industry. So the ISP community, who are passionately opposed to this, should put forward a group of people, and every 6 months they should look at the list again to make sure Steve or Kevin haven't slipped anything on. So we're looking at an extra new layer of accountability, because Australians are rightfully concerned, suspicious. They want to make sure that we're not abusing our capacity. So those are the sorts of extra accountability measures that we're looking at announcing over the next month or two. We've had a really good feedback from the process, some very colourful feedback. It's not possible for me to do some of the things that were suggested as a process. But we think that's really valuable. So we're just taking our time, we're having a think about that, and we'll probably put out a discussion paper and say, look, here's what we think is the best of the ideas. Has anyone got any further suggestions so that we can get the feedback to make sure that people can have the confidence, because it's really important if you're going to do something like this that people have got the confidence in the system. You're right, people are suspicious. So that's why we think it's really important to have this independent, arm's length from government, person, organisation, group, committee that will study this to make sure the government isn't abusing its position.
Just a final quick question. What you've outlined a lot of thoughts tonight. Any problems in the Senate with any of that?
Look, the NBN Co exists irrespective of the Senate. A lot of people think, if the legislation doesn't pass, the NBN Co will stop. It will not. The legislation that's before the Parliament at the moment deals with, obviously, some aspects dealing with that are important to Telstra and Telstra shareholders. But it also deals with a whole range of consumer protections that we believe are necessary as well. So it's very frustrating that the legislation in the Senate at the moment is like there's 38 confirmed votes and a sort of Steve Fielding moves backwards and forwards. The Coalition have said that they don't support the legislation. So we're not quite sure if we put it to the test. We're in constant negotiations with all of the minor parties. But the Senate can't stop the NBN. It can stop some important consumer protection measures, which is what it's doing at the moment. The second bill, which is caused more widespread concern, is just a draft bill we put out for consultation. So we're not anticipating that legislation, even after the input from the community, will proceed too far. Probably in the second half of the year, we'll put out here's a final draft of the bill that we're putting into Parliament. But the Senate has been cooperative in some areas. The satellite bill I mentioned before, for the new satellite service, I think that'll get rushed through Parliament before the 30th of June, which would be great because the satellite's going to be up and working by then, so we do need the bill. But on sensible things like that, which aren't political per se, the Senate is willing to cooperate. On other material, well, the Senate's the Senate. I was in opposition for 11 and a half years. I'm used to the debate, but it would be fair to say that the obstructionism has reached new levels. And I don't just mean blocking bills, the actual running of the Senate. We can't get any extra days. They won't give us any extra sitting hours. They continually hijack. In the Senate, we have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that's government business. Thursday, opposition business. The opposition have regularly decided that they're going to because they've got the numbers to do this, they're going to put their bills on during government business. They've regularly decided, no, you can't put that bill on. We'll only let you proceed if you put this bill on. So the level of obstructionism in the Senate has actually reached quite significant new levels, which isn't just about, oh, we're going to vote your bill down. I wish they would. I wish we could get a vote to vote some of these bills down. But what they're actually doing is hijacking the daily running of the Senate in a way that most of you would find quite extraordinary. They actually still think they're in government. Haven't been in opposition for 11 and a half years. It takes you a couple of years to work out you're not in government. It took us about 8 years. In fact, it took us up until when John Howard won control of the Senate. Because you think you're doing a great job on politics by blocking things all the time in the Senate. You know, oh, we block this, you know, we're relevant, we're important. And the average Australian has no idea what you got up to. You've actually got to get out on the ground like we did with the broadband plan and campaign on it for a couple of years. I mean, Gerald, I think I spoke to you before I whacked about our plan. So we're out there campaigning on the ground, doing little travelling road shows around Australia. I did 42 in the period of about 8 months, which mightn't sound like a lot, but I promise you it is, when you've actually got to get to some of the places we visited. So you've got to get out and campaign on the ground to ensure that you're getting the message out. You can't just think, hey, we voted something down in the Senate. Because usually what happens in the Senate is you say, this is bills, the sky's going to fall if we pass this bill. Then we amend it. We take the edges off it. And it gets passed, and it doesn't. The sky didn't fall. And punters go, what were they on about? Now, you're actually self-defeating. By taking the edges off it in the Senate, you actually make your job of getting re-elected harder. One day the opposition will work that out. Thank you very much.
Many thanks. Here tonight, and I'll be very brief. It's great to have Senator Conroy along. He was here in his opposition days as communications. He was here in as government, and again as minister for 2.5 years. But what was constant in all those three appearances, and there was some before that as well on other issues, is Senator Conroy's obvious passion for what he's on about, and that comes through. And it's great to have a minister here tonight to give us an important talk across his whole portfolio for half an hour, take over half an hour of questions from all sorts of people here on all kinds of issues. You've done a great job, and we'd love to have you back sometime after the next election, but for tonight, well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.